Morning, I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Maryland Morning. We'll start today with a look at the Howard Conservancy. Meg Boyd, the Conservancy's executive director and Howard County High School teacher Ann Strozik, tell us what they're doing to educate students and adults about environmental stewardship. Then, Vladimir Nabokov is profiled in a new biography that concentrates on his fertile time in America, which led to masterpieces like Lolita and Pale Fire. From his books to his butterflies, a new look at a literary master. Plus, red meat and processed meat. How much is too much? The Nutrition Diva explains the latest research, Tom Pelton puts the environment in focus, and Nathan Sterner has the local news. Maryland Morning starts right now, live from Studio A. First up, the national headlines.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
And good morning, everybody. On 88.1, that's Nathan Sterner. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Maryland Morning. We're going to begin today with a look at the Howard County Conservancy. It's a 200-acre tract of rolling hills, forest, meadow, and streams called Mount Pleasant Farm. It's in Woodstock, about a half hour's drive west of Baltimore. The Conservancy, which marked its 25th anniversary last Sunday, introduces young people and adults to environmental stewardship and conservation. To tell us more about it, I'm joined in the studio by its executive director, Meg Boyd, and Ann Strozik. She's an award-winning environmental educator in the Howard County School System, who is based at the Conservancy. Welcome to you both. Good morning and welcome to you both. How are you doing?
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Meg, I've never been out there. I know probably a few of our listeners have not been out as well. Tell us about the Conservancy.
Well, the Conservancy is a very unique property. As you mentioned, 232 acres. We have 4 miles of trails. And it came to the Conservancy from the Brown sisters. They were the last of 8 generations of their family to own and live at the farm. The sisters were public school teachers for 50 years, starting in the one-room schoolhouses of Howard County. And they, at the end of their lives, said they wanted to preserve the property and use it for education. And it came to the Conservancy to carry out their wishes for the property.
All right, so they were into teaching from the very beginning.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, yeah. You know, the foresight, 232 acres in Howard County, obviously a lot of development value. So the foresight of these teachers to recognize the opportunity to use it for educational programming was just really wonderful for the community.
Mm-hmm. And Ann Strozik, you coordinate your educational activities with the Howard County School System. How does that work?
It's wonderful. We have a terrific partnership between the Howard County Conservancy and the science department, secondary science. We work very closely to make sure that our field experiences are aligned with all of our next-gen science standards and the curriculum. So we work very closely together.
What are the next-gen science standards? That's edgy speak, and I don't know what that means.
Okay. Well, simply, it's not easy to put simply, but it's a fantastic directives, helping teachers to create authentic science experiences for students.
Mm-hmm. And this is all part of the STEM stuff, the science, technology, engineering, math. It's all rolled up into that?
Absolutely.
And you've just gotten a big chunk of change from NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, $310,000, and that's going to go towards the Bay and Watershed Training Program. What's that all about?
Well, the NOAA Be Wet grant program funded our project, which is the Watershed Report Card. And this is a very unique program that we're doing. We are actually having students turn the table. The students create a report card on the health of the watershed in Howard County. And they do that by stream studies, by evaluating the health of their schoolyard, collecting authentic data, evaluating it throughout the year, engaging with subject matter experts, and then actually presenting their report card and their grade on the health of the watershed to elected officials in Howard County. And we have just found that because the students are doing the actual data collection, they are fully vested in this data and in their evaluation of it and in the results and recommendations, and the elected officials are really paying attention because it's the students that are doing the evaluating and coming to them with a report.
Yeah, we're usually testing them all the time.
Correct.
This time they're testing us,
right,
you know, as the stewards of this. Let me ask you a dumb question because I'm a dumb guy. When people use the term watershed, What does that mean?
Well, a watershed is all of the area that drains into a body of water. So, of course, the Chesapeake Bay is our big body of water. But in areas like Howard County, we have enormous networks of streams that are all also draining into the rivers that drain into the Chesapeake Bay. So students are looking at their sub-watersheds in Howard County, so sort of the micro area that's draining into the streams and the rivers.
Because they're actually looking like around their schools and the parking lots and all that kind of stuff. So Anstruther, for example, things like runoff, I mean, people have referred to the fees that have been assessed on various counties as the rain tax. Do they learn about that, and they learn about the implications in their particular area?
Absolutely. So what's great about this program is students do not even have to be bussed off to learn about watershed education. They start right in their schoolyard. They evaluate their schoolyard looking at invasive plants, erosion, what is actually in their stormwater pond. And then as we go through the year, because it's a full year project, by the time we're finished in fourth quarter, they do learn about civics and how, what is the rain tax and how is it being used. They hear from government agencies, local. They hear from our Senator Cardin as well. We've had some, he was out just last week listening to the students and engaging mm-hmm. with them.
Yeah, so there is an impact on public policy if they're giving the state data. The Bay had a decent report card last year. In 2014, it scored 50%, which does seem kind of keeping the bar pretty low. And the only reason people were calling it decent was because it was up from 45% in 2013. That's an overall grade done by the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science. Anne, are you finding that kids are, when you talk about an authentic learning experience, that's another little edu-speak term. What does that mean?
Authentic means they are hands-on in the stream, collecting the data for themselves, analyzing it themselves. We are coaching them, sharing with them how to do the protocols, but they are literally digging in and looking at the color charts to figure out what, you know, what the probes say and what the tests signify. So that's what we mean authentic. And also authentic in that they are examining a real question, a driving question. What is the health of our watersheds? Some of them have never been to a stream. Why would they care? Unless they have the opportunity to look at it from their schoolyard and then also in the stream. It becomes personal.
Yeah. And Meg Boyd, I think it does become personal if they are actually involved, you know, physically in it. And I think it's almost, in my experience, it's almost geographic. I mean, like when I'm out west, I was in Alaska a couple of years ago, the connection to the environment by people in Alaska seemed considerably stronger mm-hmm. than it does on people on the right mm-hmm. to people on the right coast mm-hmm. on mm-hmm. the east coast. You know,
right.
the left coasters just they have an immediacy about the environment mm-hmm. that we don't have, particularly in urban areas. Is this something that you're finding as you've, you know, been running these education programs for a long time?
It is. As Anne mentioned, we're finding a large number of students haven't even been to streams in Howard County. And when they do their stream study, when our high schools do their stream study, we pick a stream that's close to their school or in their neighborhood. And a lot of these kids didn't even know a stream was there. You know, it's through a little path, through a little patch of woods. And when we get them down there to actually start testing the streams, it's sort of an aha moment for them that this stream is here and the rain from my house and my schoolyard is washing down into this stream.
Yeah. And Storzy, when you talk about environmental literacy, you know, for a young person or for that matter, for an adult, what does that mean in your mind?
Environmental literacy is, well, even just getting to your watershed question, what is a watershed? Why should I care about these environmental issues? So that, you know, there's a big push in across the state for E-Lit, we call it environmental literacy, so that when students graduate, they'll be fully competent in those issues and know the hows and the whys and the ramifications, and then they go to be voters and hopefully can be more knowledgeable when they vote on these, like the rain tax and all these other issues that are coming up.
There are a lot of issues that people point to generational differences in. One of them is marriage equality, for example. People have found that younger people really have very little problem with gay people being married. It's just not a big deal the way it is for their parents and grandparents. Do you think that there's a generational difference between young people's approach and interest in the environment as opposed to people in the generations that preceded them?
Absolutely. We definitely.
So it's getting better, in other words.
I think so. I know that we at the Conservancy are reaching thousands of students each year, just getting them outside and engaging. I will say, you know, technology is an interesting piece because there's a lot of pros and a lot of cons, and a lot of our young students are very used to this technology. So one way that we have found to get them outside is to use the technology to investigate the world around them using a lot of citizen science applications.
Yep, there's an app for that, isn't there?
Yes. Yeah.
And speaking of, there's an app for that. You know, one thing we like to say, especially about this program, is that it's not the answers. The answers are easy. All of these kids have a cell phone in their pocket, and they can Google the answer to anything. What's important is the question and the driving questions that we are asking when we challenge the students to do this research.
Mm-hmm. The NOAA grant was $310,000. The state is matching, giving you a $250,000 grant. That's for an expansion that you're mm-hmm. going to do. So I think folks understand where that money goes. Where does mm-hmm. the $310,000 go in this watershed report card thing? How do you actually spend that money?
Well, a lot of that is transportation money, so all of the buses to get the students to all of these streams. We also have the stream study supplies, so the nets and the chemical testing supplies and the probes and those sorts of things. We have a group of watershed coaches who are really key to this project because they are the ones that go back into every single high school every quarter and meet with the teachers, meet with the students, help them analyze the data, help them develop the report card. So a large chunk of the funding goes to support the watershed coaches that are working every quarter in the schools.
Yeah, there's a lot that goes into it. And how do you coordinate it, Anne, with the school system? This is clearly integrated into the curriculum that they're hearing about in the classroom as well.
We spend a lot of time before the kids even start school preparing the teachers, running professional development. We have wonderful partners that help us with this grant. Department of Natural Resources come out and teach the teachers how to investigate the stream. So we empower the teachers right along with the students. The confidence of watershed education, you know, they feel more confident in working right along with us.
Great.
So it's really the prep.
All right. Well, Anne and Meg, thank you so much to both of you, and continue the great work. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Meg Boyd is the executive director of the Howard County Conservancy in Woodstock, Maryland. Anne Strozik is an environmental educator for the Howard County School System, who is based at the Conservancy. On Friday night at 7 o'clock, there's a flashlight hike to check out the nocturnal life at the Conservancy just in time for Halloween. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up after a break for news, a conversation with Robert Roper about his new biography of Vladimir Nabokov, a very smart guy. Speaking of smart guys, here's Nathan Sterner.
Thanks, Tom. You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of your public radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at wypr.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@wypr.org. Now, back to the podcast.
Lolita, light of my life, fire of my loins, my sin, my soul. Lolita, the tip of the tongue taking a trip of three steps down the palate to tap at three on the teeth. Lolita. She was low, plain low, in the morning, standing 4 feet 10 in one sock. She was Lola in slacks. She was Dolly at school. She was Dolores on the dotted line. But in my arms, she was always Lolita.
With those lines published in 1955, Vladimir Nabokov begins his most famous novel, which shocked the world and placed him in the highest echelon of modern writers. In a new biography, my next guest examines Nabokov's time in America in the years leading up to and after the publication of Lolita. Robert Roper is a novelist and journalist who is on the faculty of Johns Hopkins University. He'll be appearing at the Ivy Bookshop tonight to talk about the book. It's called Nabokov in America, On the Road to Lolita. It's nice to meet you, Mr. Roper. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So he spent 20 years in America. This book covers the period roughly from 1940 to 1960, but he really had a life that was very much on the move. Trace for us briefly what happened before he came to America. Born in St. Petersburg, Russia, and then he moved around a lot.
Yeah, right. Born in 1899. His father was a very influential, fabulously wealthy family. And they lost everything in the revolution. His father was politically liberal. The Bolsheviks didn't like him. So they escaped with other Russians to Berlin, and he lived in Berlin almost 20 years, the son, and became a writer, started publishing, got a small reputation among Russian readers. He was writing in Russian. But he was married to a Jewish woman. They had a little boy. And as the 30s advanced, they knew they had to get out of Germany. So they escaped 1937 to France. But the writing was on the wall about the war. And so the Nazis were soon in France. And they just barely got out of France on the last ship going to the United States before all shipping was shut down by the war. And so 1940, they arrived in America. And he had some English, but he had not written very much in English. I mean, he was a native Russian speaker. So he reconfigured himself as an American writer and began publishing books in English.
You quote a diary of Nabokov. He says that by the age of 14, I had read all of Tolstoy in Russian, all of Shakespeare in English, and all of Flaubert in French. There's an incredible intellect here at play here, isn't it? It's astonishing.
Yeah, it is astonishing, although we need to remember that Europeans learn a lot of languages. If they go to a good school, it's not that strange to run into an educated European these days, too, who speaks four or five languages. Nabokov was very fluent in French, English, and Russian. I'm very impressed as a crude American by that, but it wasn't unthinkable that somebody would have that many languages.
So he's married to a woman named Vera. You write about a pretty healthy sexual appetite both before he got married and while he was married. What was that relationship like?
Yeah, it was one of the more profound and interesting writer and devoted wife relationships in modern history. There's a tradition in Russian literature of devoted, brilliant wives who stand behind their husbands and often argue with them. Dostoevsky had such a wife, Tolstoy, and Vera. Very early on, she became intoxicated with the poetry of this unknown young poet, Nabokov. This is in the 1920s. And they met, believe it or not, at a masked ball. And he started chatting her up, and she started quoting his poetry back to him. And he became fascinated, of course.
Yeah, that'll do it.
Who is this woman? And the thing started from there. So she believed deeply in his writing, and she worked very hard her whole life as his literary agent and as his editor. She typed up his manuscripts. He never really learned to type, just as he never really learned how to drive a car. So on their long trips all over the American West in the summers after they got here, she did all the driving.
Yeah, incredible. And they covered like 200,000 miles or something, you estimate.
Right.
And he was in search of all things, butterflies. He was really, at one point in the 1940s, you talk about how he was really doing very little writing and that he was almost thinking of himself more as a lepidopterist, a butterfly expert than a writer.
Right, right. His parents, these very wealthy Russian, upper-class Russians, were kind of amateur naturalists, and they were very interested in butterfly collecting, especially his father, and they turned young Vladimir onto that, and he really took to it. He adored it. It's funny, I find a remarkable parallel between him and certain American writers of the 20th century who we usually don't think of in the same pairing. Faulkner and Hemingway, both big hunters. And Nabokov writes about the natural world with the same richness and the same adoration of wildness that they show. He was hunting butterflies, and they were hunting whatever. But from a very early age, he loved to get out into wild forests and mountains.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, I guess people have the stereotypical notion of what a writer is this, you know, slightly crazed person who, you know, hermits himself or herself in a garret somewhere and, you know, writes novels. But Nabokov, you write, was very strategic about getting a career and establishing an American readership writing in English. He had, at that point, had published nine works in Russian. But he was no crazy artiste. He was purposeful about getting his career off the ground in the United States.
Very, very smart about it. And he took advice. I mean, this is one of the most condescending and superior writers you could ever hope to meet. All right, he had read everything, he knew everything, but in fact, he was very alert to information from any source. And he had, I found in my researches for this book, he had extraordinary friendships with ordinary Americans. And he would pick their brain, and he had great times going out with guys collecting butterflies. A lot of them didn't know he was a writer. They said, yeah, he's that guy with a funny accent who knows everything about butterflies, and it's just tremendous to be with him. We laughed the whole day. And he had a, I wouldn't even call it a common touch, because it was just very natural to him.
On 88.1, it's Marilyn Morning. I'm Tom Hall. My guest this morning is Robert Roper. He is the author of a new biography of Vladimir Nabokov. It's called Nabokov in America, On the Road to Lolita. Some of his friends were not just ordinary Americans. They were pretty famous writers. One of them is Edmund Wilson. You write a lot about Mr. Wilson. They had a very close relationship, which fell apart eventually after about 20 years of that in what you call a public bloodletting. They were mean to each other in print. What was the influence of Wilson? And one of the influences might be a book that Wilson had written. It was a sex novel, or a novel that had a lot about sex in it, called The Memoirs of Hecate County. Is that how I pronounce it?
Hecate
County. Was Wilson an influence on Nabokov as a writer as well as a friend?
Yeah, he was. It was great good fortune for Vladimir. He came over here penniless in 1940. His cousin, Nicholas Nabokov, a composer, had come a couple of years earlier, and he had luckily befriended this guy, Edmund Wilson, who just happened to be the most influential literary journalist in America, and a wonderful man who was very, very generous to other writers, very generous. And so Nicholas introduced them, and they struck up a friendship. And at that time, Wilson was particularly interested in Russian literature. So to him, it was just thrilling to be with Vladimir. And Vladimir also loved Wilson's company. They laughed about a lot of things. They were both pedants. They had read everything. They would exchange books. They would exchange fabulous letters that have been collected. They're wonderful to read. So this was a wonderful friendship. And then Wilson, in his customary generous style, said, you know, would you like to publish some stuff at the New Republic? I've got a friend who's an editor there. How about the New Yorker? You ever thought of publishing there? And Nabokov, yes, this innocent from, of course he had read the New Yorker. He had been reading American magazines when he was in Europe, so years before. So he said, yeah, that sounds good. So,
yeah, so Wilson, a really big boost to his career.
Yeah, right? He opened many doors, many doors.
And of course, Lolita, his most famous novel, and after Lolita, there are very few butterfly collectors who probably didn't know who he was, because, I mean, the splash that this book made, both negative and positive, was really quite something. We actually have a clip of Nabokov discussing Lolita. This is with a guy from the CBC named Pierre Burton, along with the writer Lionel Trilling. This is on television, and you write about this. Here's Nabokov himself talking about Lolita, and of course, people's first reaction to the book was that it was basically pornography.
Think so? I don't think so. Well, first of all, I don't wish to touch hearts, and I don't even want to affect minds very much. What I want to produce is really that little sob in the spine of the artist reader. Well, I leave the field of ideas to Dr. Schweitzer and to Dr. Zhivago. When you say satire, you imply a purpose, an object, an awakening. Apart from and beyond the dream of the book, I have invented in America, my America, and just as fantastic as any inventor's America.
And could you be more attractive?
Well, I think that you have noticed, but some reviewers have not noticed, how helpless and how lovely she is. It was fun to breed her in my own laboratory. But I'm not concerned in holding up public abuses to ridicule or that kind of thing.
So he writes a book about a pedophile and a captive young girl. The man Humbert, who is the protagonist in the book, marries her mother basically to get to her, to get to Lolita. What makes this book so great? I mean, because no one dismisses it as a not great piece of literature.
Oh, but, a lot of people do. Well, I want to say, before I try to answer that, I want to say that that interview with Nabokov is, to me, is really funny because every word out of his mouth needs to be doubted. he's not lying, but he's, you know, creating obscurity around the truth. Like, he was basically determined to say, I wasn't trying to write a book that would touch readers or make you care for this poor little girl who's turned into a sex slave. I don't care about reforming society. But in fact, he did write a book that does make you care, and he did bring pedophilia into public discourse. So why is it a great book?
It a great book then?
Yeah, I think it's a great book. And I had an unsettling experience. I came home one day. My 11-year-old daughter was curled up on the couch, and she was laughing over a paperback. And she was kind of, you know, an early, ambitious reader. She liked to read books. And I always said, oh, take anything off my shelves you want to read, sweetheart. Well, she was reading Lolita. And I said, wait a minute, Katie, you know, I'm not sure you should read that. And she was just reading it, and for its depiction of America, she didn't understand exactly what was going on in it. But the sentence by sentence, it's very, very funny and very true. Anybody who's grown up in America recognizes the truth of the descriptions of motels and roadside cafes, the whole kit of 1950s America. So just on the level of a good book about our world, it's just fantastic.
There is actually a line of interpretation, criticism of Lolita that calls it basically a representation, if you will, an analog to old Europe debauching young America. Do you buy that line of
interpretation? Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's one of the things that Nabokov liked to laugh. Some critics say it's old Europe debauching young America. I had no intention. I don't believe in symbols. And of course it is about that. I mean, it's about a lot of things that he denied and that he parodied. But that doesn't really describe the whole story. I mean, it's a very funny, true, moving story. Some people read it and say, what's all the talk about? I don't like this. I'm made uncomfortable by this, and I don't think he's so great. And, you know, there are many opinions about any work of art, but I think the only thing to do is try it yourself. Get a nice, cheap paperback copy and read a couple of pages. Yeah. If you're not captivated, put it down.
Yeah, the subject is appalling, and the writing is, in my view at least, just, you know, extraordinary. So that's one of those paradoxes. Okay, well, thanks so much. The book is a very interesting read. I appreciate it. Robert Roper, the book is called Nabokov in America, On the Road to Lolita. Mr. Roper will be speaking and signing copies of his book at the Ivy Bookshop in North Baltimore tonight at 7 o'clock. We've got all the details on our website, wipr.org/Marilyn Morning. By the way, thanks to senior producer Rob Civic for reading the Lolita excerpt at the top of this segment. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up later on the broadcast, Monica Reinagle, the nutrition diva, helps us sort out this week's news about red meat and processed meat. The International Agency for Research on Cancer has weighed in with some new recommendations, and Monica will let us know what that means for carnivores and vegetarians alike.
Is there an issue you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or leave us a voicemail at 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. Again, that's wypr.org/Marilyn Morning. Now, on with the show.
Back in the day when we heard this music by Aaron Copland, we knew it meant one thing, meat. In the 1990s, it was what's for dinner, according to the Beef Council. Last February, the federal government revised its guidelines about what we should eat, and they said we should eat less meat
And in fairness to meat, they also suggested that we should eat less sugar. On Monday, the International Agency for Research on Cancer, which is part of the World Health Organization, published a report that seems to have upped the ante a bit. Red meat has been declared a probable carcinogen. The verdict on processed meat, according to the study, is even more severe. When it comes to bacon and beef jerky, they drop the qualifier probable, and they say that it is a carcinogen. So what does this mean? Whenever we have a question of this kind, we turn to our nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle, who blogs about nutrition at Nutrition Over Easy, and who hosts the podcast at quickanddirtytips.com. Hey, Monica, good to see you.
Good morning, Tom.
So what is this report saying?
Well, exactly as you said, they have designated these two categories of foods in two slightly different classifications, the processed meat, and that's things like bacon, ham, cured meats that have been treated to extend their shelf life and often to turn them pink. They are now in this category as a carcinogen. And then the fresh red meats, that would be your beef, pork, veal, are labeled as probable carcinogens. You know, this got so much attention when this came out on Monday, but it's not really anything new. This is not a new study. There are no new data. It's just another analysis of data that we've had and that have been analyzed before.
This is one of those metadata analyses. So in other words, they weren't conducting their own experiments. They were sort of compiling the results of experiments that had been conducted by many, many researchers around the world.
Exactly. And that's been done many times before. This also wasn't unexpected. This was pretty much what we expected them to say. It's not surprising when you understand what the Agency for Research on Cancer does. This was not a statement of your risk from eating these foods. This was a hazard assessment. And there's a
what's the difference in risk and hazard? That's interesting.
Huge difference. So a sharp knife is a hazard. It's a cutting hazard. And whether it's sheathed in a knife block in your drawer or it's in the in the dishwasher sticking with the knife blade sticking up where you can grab it by mistake or balanced on the edge of your counter, it's the same hazard. But the risk of being cut is very different depending on those different scenarios. So what IARC is doing is they are trying to identify hazards. And they've identified a lot of them. They have reviewed over 940 some agents. They're not all food. Some of them are chemicals. Some of them are lifestyle habits, like how much sleep you get, to see if they could be hazards for cancer. And of those 942, only one was found to be not carcinogenic. So it is really important. What they are saying here has nothing to do with your risk of getting cancer from eating red meat or processed meat. It just says that there's something in those foods that under the right circumstances could promote cancer.
And it's a matter of degree. I mean, they talk about the fact that there is sufficient evidence, what the report says, in human beings for the carcinogenicity of the consumption of processed meat, sufficient evidence. And then with red meat, which is regular red meat, not processed red meat, they say there's limited evidence for human beings and carcinogenicity.
Right. That's an important distinction because I think a lot of people understood that to mean that processed meat is way more dangerous. Mm-hmm. What it really means is they're more confident in the evidence.
Yeah.
They feel more secure in reaching that conclusion. It says nothing about the relative dangers between those two foods. In this particular case, the evidence that we do have that separates them out, because a lot of the studies that they're using for evaluate, they just lump it all together. They don't distinguish between fresh meat and processed meat. It's just one big category that includes everything from pork tenderloin to pepperoni.
Yeah.
But in those studies where they looked at them separately, there does seem to be a slightly higher risk from processed meat than from fresh red meat, but it's really not that big a difference. It's like the difference between an 18% risk increase in risk and a 19% increase in risk. Mm-hmm. But let's put these risk numbers in perspective for people.
Yeah.
So your risk of—
It doesn't seem like that much of a difference.
It's
1%. I mean, I don't know.
Right. The difference between red and processed meat is not that big. The difference in this classification, again, has to do with their confidence in the evidence, not the magnitude of the risk. But to put this in perspective, your lifetime risk of colon cancer is about 5%. So 1 in 20 people will get colon cancer over the course of their lives. Among the heaviest consumers of red and processed meat, that risk goes up to about 6%, or 1 in 18. So that also is not a huge risk. It is a 20% increase, but when you shrink it down to its to the absolute risk, you know, we're still talking about a 5 or 6% risk of colon cancer. And the other thing that I think it's important to underline here is that what I said, the heaviest consumers.
Right.
The people that we're seeing this increase in risk, these are people who are eating red and processed meat one or more times a day.
Yeah.
And their risk is increased relative to the people that eat the least red meat. But that group that eats the least includes not only people who never eat red meat, but it also includes people who are eating red or processed meat once a week or less.
Yeah.
They're no increased risk.
And of course, it does come down to frequency and portion size, too.
Yes.
And we've talked about this before. I mean, when it comes to fast food, for example, there are about 18 million people, about 6% of Americans, eat fast food seven times a week or more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and these are the people that McDonald's and Burger King and Wendy's are going after. I mean, the ads on television are aimed at those people.
Oh, Tom, I'm sure they're having the salad.
Yeah,
oh,
absolutely. Don't we all? You know, I used to read Playboy for the articles, too. But you know,
now you have no choice.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. And I'll sit there with my beef burger at Burger King and read these fascinating articles. But frequency does matter. I mean,
there is a dose response here, meaning that your risk goes up the more you eat. And really, all of the comparisons are between, as I said, the people that are really eating, you know, several pounds of this stuff a week compared to people who are eating it. And there's one other way that you can reduce your risk, actually erase your risk. Interestingly, even in those people who are eating red and processed meat once a day, that increased risk disappears in those who are also eating a lot of vegetables.
So it counterbalances.
Yes. So people who are eating a lot of red meat but are also eating a lot of vegetables, they're in the same risk category as people who are eating little to no red meat.
Yeah.
So there is some good news, but you know, I'm not saying that we should be eating more red meat. I think there are a lot of good reasons, some of which have nothing to do with nutrition.
Right.
To limit the amount of red meat that we eat, and also just to make sure that we're getting our protein from a variety of sources. If you're eating a lot of red meat, if you're eating it every day, then chances are probably pretty good that you're not eating fish very often. And we know that eating fish a couple of times a week.
So you're losing the opportunity to get the nutrients you could get from fish were you to eat it once or twice.
Right. Yeah. So the impact of what you're eating also has to do with what you're not eating because you're eating that instead. So I think there's a lot to be said for getting our protein from a variety of sources, including fish or poultry, including vegetable sources of protein.
Mm-hmm.
But red meat once a week or even a hot dog once a week is not taking your life into your hands.
Yeah. Well, and of course, you know, we even talk about how people define red meat. We had a conversation about this.
Yes.
You know, there are people, the pork industry, which is included in this study, they call it red meat. But the pork people would say we're the other white meat. So, you know,
there's all that marketing stuff.
Yeah, they didn't buy that. All right. Well, Monica Reinagel, always great to see you. Thank you so much. We'll see you next time.
My pleasure.
Monica Reinagel is the nutrition diva. Come to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. We'll give you a link to more information on the new meat study, and we'll also have links to Monica's blog, Nutrition Over Easy, and her weekly podcasts at quickanddirtytips.com. That's it for us today. Hope you can join us Friday. We'll have a status update on the Baltimore mayor's race with Taylor Stewart from Leadership for Educational Equity and Fern Shen from the Baltimore Brew. We will do our best to identify at least three people who are not running for mayor. That's going to be tough. We'll also learn about an historic African-American radio station in Annapolis, and we'll hear some music from the new CD by Ensemble Galilee. That's Friday morning on Maryland Morning. Until then, for Nathan Sterner and the entire Maryland Morning team, I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.